extra dimensions in terms of exploring some of the different solutions. I try to give you a flavor of some of the useful higher dimensional gravitating solutions in both vacuum gravity as well as gravity with extra fields. Now, I gather you haven't really done much of a string theory course yet. So if you're sort of somebody who trembles at the sound of string theory, don't worry. It's just gravity with some extra fields in it. So just think of it that way. And if you like string theory, then you'll see the use of it eventually. And we also looked at Kaluza-Klein theory. So we're moving towards thinking about higher dimensional gravity, but more from a practical point of view in the sense of if there are extra dimensions, we don't see them, so how do we hide them? And so in Kaluza-Klein theory, the idea was we hid them by making them very small. And so we imagined some little manifold sort of tacked onto our big space-time. And what traces does it leave in our four-dimensional gravity, and how can we constrain that? So that was the sort of point of yesterday's second lecture. So today, what I want to do is cover some general formalism, which goes under sort of Gauss-Kodazy, it's called. And it's like geometry of submanifolds. So the use of this is, well, there's sort of several uses of it. First of all, we're going to use, or we can use it as a means of describing our brains or lower dimensional objects. We also use it to make the action principle well defined. I quite carefully flagged up the issue of the variational principle in general relativity. And also in general, as well as making our variational principle accurate, it also makes computing actions, makes more sense of it. So if I just sort of put those three bullet points down, which one's that? So if you remember our variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action, we got something that looked like the Einstein piece. So we got the Einstein tensor, but our boundary term, which normally you can set to zero because you vary your fields and then say that the variation of the field vanishes, on the boundary. And the problem with the Einstein-Hilbert action, because it's second order, they've got chocolate muffins. Because it's second order in derivatives of the metric, you end up with normal derivatives of the variation on the boundary, not just delta G on the boundary. So although we ignored that and pressed ahead with the bulk term, it was still there's still something a little bit sort of not watertight about the process. So perhaps if we treat the boundary dynamically as well, maybe this will solve the problem. So that's sort of one flag that I brought up as we were doing variational principles. Another thing which I don't think I emphasize, but I've been mentioning it as a bit of a sort of running theme in the background of some of the lectures, is we've looked a little bit at Euclideanizing solutions. So I did it when I got the sort of cheats method or the easy method for finding black hole temperatures. I've also analytically continued when I was trying to motivate that the black ring solution really was a solution of vacuum Einstein gravity in five dimensions. And you saw that it was a ring from analytic continuation of the C metric. But when you do analytically continue, so what you're doing is kind of computing an instanton. So this is a Euclidean solution that represents a tunneling process. So the problem with this, or the first problem that you could think of with this type of interpretation of Euclideanized gravitational solutions, is that because vacuum solutions satisfy the Ricci tensor being zero, if you compute the Einstein-Hilbert action, it's always going to be zero because R is zero. So if you naively just compute the integral of R root G, that's zero for every single vacuum solution you can find. So it's zero for Minkowski space, that might not worry you, but if it's also zero for Schwarzschild, for a sort of plane-fronted gravitational wave, for even two black holes merging, there's a whole set of very different physical space-times for which this action vanishes. So that seems a little bit odd. If you've got very physically distinct solutions, why do they all have the same action? And in fact, that action being zero, that there's something not quite right about that. And then the other sort of motivating, this is kind of feeding in a little bit to the previous point, but another motivating feature for thinking about submanifolds is that we've talked about these brain world type solutions, brain solutions. We've also looked in four dimensions at cosmic strings and domain walls. And the gravitating solutions that I wrote down were of objects of essentially zero width. And so those objects look like lower dimensional surfaces or lower dimensional submanifolds. So can we use a description of submanifolds? Can we actually get a formalism that allows us to describe these lower dimensional objects in a nice mathematical way? So these are the sort of issues, those are the bullet points, question points that we're going to explore in setting up the geometry of submanifolds. So that's kind of different ways in which we might apply this formalism. So, as I said, this is known as Gauss-Kadatze. And the basic idea behind it is to, if you have some submanifold living in your higher dimensional manifold, you want to be able to split quantities into things that live on or are parallel to the submanifold and things that are normal to the submanifold. So that's really the basic idea behind it. You're performing a sort of splitting into these two distinct spaces or quantities. So the picture is that we have some submanifold, surface, whatever, which we'll call sigma, which lives in your higher dimensional space-time. So the idea is that if you just looked at sigma itself, then sigma would be a manifold in its own right. So I'm kind of assuming that sigma itself behaves like a manifold, but it's also living as some subset in our full space-time manifold M. And so then we say that sigma has codimension d minus n, so basically it's just the difference between the dimensionality of the full manifold and sigma. And that means that there exist d minus n normals or linearly independent normals. So the idea of a normal is that if you've got some coordinate functions, sigma A, which coordinatize the surface sigma for you, then the normal vector acting on those functions just vanishes. So in other words, it's saying that N is normal to the surface sigma. So another way of writing this is, we want to write it in sort of index or indices. We can say that this vector, so here's our normal vector n, which I've now lowered the index with respect to the metric. So x mu here are the coordinates of sigma in a local chart on M. And so if you take d by d sigma a of x mu, what you're doing is you're sort of taking a tangent vector here that lies within sigma. So it's quite easy to visualize what's going on in terms of a sphere, for example. A sphere has a normal that's just a radially outward pointing vector. And the radial vector is, of course, normal to the theta and phi directions, which are tangent to the sphere. So that's simply saying, you know, what sigma is and what, you know, what the normals are. So we'll now just define some sort of useful objects. So what we need to do if we're thinking about splitting our geometry into things parallel and perpendicular to sigma is we've got to think about sort of how the metric and how the curvature split up parallel and perpendicular to sigma. So the first thing we need to do is think about the metric on sigma. So the first fundamental form is denoted as H. And I'm sorry about that. It's total convention that H gets used for a couple of different things in gravity. It's also used for a perturbation of the metric, conventionally, but anyway. So what it is you take the metric, and then you subtract off all bits of the metric that are normal to sigma. So this minus sign here is simply saying that this quantity here is minus one if n is time-like, and it's plus one if n is space-like. With my signature. So H is really just a projection of the metric onto the surface sigma. But it still lives in the tangent, well, the cotangent bundle of M. So these A and B indices are still sort of manifold indices, M indices. So it's the distance that sigma, distance function that sigma inherits from the manifold. It's also known as the induced metric. And it's related to what you would say was a metric intrinsic to sigma. So as I've suggested by saying that this thing is still living in the tangent, sort of tangent bundle of M, you can also think of sigma as a manifold in its own right. So in other words, you could imagine that maybe if you lived on sigma, you didn't even know about the existence of M. And then you would be saying, well, my local coordinate charts are just these sigma A, and these are the only dimensions I know about. And so you can therefore imagine a point of view which is intrinsic to sigma. So there's no knowledge of the outside space-time. So all I'm trying to do here is to say, well, here's our manifold sigma, which has dimension little n. I've got coordinates sigma a here. Over here, I've got my space-time manifold m, which is of dimension d. And so really, I have this map where this is sigma considered as a surface or a submanifold in M. And here we've simply got our coordinate functions, x mu of sigma A. So then this is, if you like, an intrinsic point of view and the intrinsic metric. Is simply the projection of the space-time metric into sigma. So what I'm doing here is I've got my capital Roman indices are all refer to tangent spaces of sigma, so this is just a completely intrinsic point of view. It's a point of view of somebody who just lives in sigma, whereas the lowercase Latin or Greek indices refer to the manifold M. So this is where although what you might, the object you might be considering might be tangent to sigma, it's nonetheless aware of the full dimensionality of the whole space-time manifold. So there's kind of two different points of view here. So then the second fundamental form, so the first one's the metric. The second fundamental form of sigma is then going to tell us about some information about the embedding. So at the moment, all we've talked about are just distances and the coordinate functions. But we also, because sigma lives within M, there's also information contained about the embedding of sigma into the manifold. And this is this is encoded in the extrinsic curvature of sigma. And so to get the extrinsic curvature, you take the covariant derivative of the normal. And so what this does is it measures how sigma curves in M. So if you have some surface that looks locally like this, you draw your normal. If I sort of parallel transport these normals here, you can see that as I move along sigma, my normal is changing direction. And this is sort of delta n. The amount by which it changes is actually, in this case, because I've got one extra dimension and I've got my normals all normalized, the variation is actually parallel to the surface. So, to all intents and purposes, yes. I mean, you can see that they're an equivalent object. in the sense of the information contained in H is the same as the information contained in gamma, but they're different objects. So one is intrinsic to the surface, the other is still simply a sort of projection operator rather than actually being something intrinsic. And so ultimately, you could imagine, although here in the context of what I'm going to talk about today, I'm completely keeping my submanifold as literally as a submanifold of M, and so therefore sigma inherits its structure from the ambient manifold. You could imagine, and indeed one does, having the intrinsic quantities and sort of quite separate, or at least in principle independent of the sort of underlying manifold, and then you would sort of look to see what consistency of those two points of view implied. So you could imagine an intrinsic metric being a sort of separate degree of freedom, but I won't be doing that for describing this formalism. So I'm really keeping with the submanifold. Yep.
Appears in Lagrangian, for example, mm-hmm. is that fundamental for me important?
So, so I guess in physics we would tend to sort of write more an intrinsic notation. Where, I mean, I'll certainly be using it today in order to derive the Gauss-Kodaczy relations, because what you ultimately want to do when you're splitting the, say, like the curvature into sort of parallel components and or perpendicular components, when you look at the parallel components, you're also getting, it's not just a projection of the Riemann tensor. So, and once you're relating, you know, if you're sort of thinking about, let's say you're thinking about this as a dynamical object which is interacting with gravity, you're putting this submanifold in as some sort of physical object, then ultimately what you're trying to solve are the bulk, the full higher dimensional Einstein equations. So strictly speaking, you should only ever be doing things with M indices, okay? Strictly speaking. But of course, you know, we're never strict as physicists, so we do the gamma actually. But I think there's quite a bit of blurring you'll find in the literature. But I'm just trying to emphasize, here, you know, what the distinctions are, because once you kind of understand distinctions, then you can go ahead and blur them and know you're doing the right thing. So.
Also, I mean, it's for one of
the... Right, yes, of course. I saw when I came in yesterday that Renata was using some of this. So yeah, that's right. So I think it depends probably on the context. Yeah. So I've there written K as a sort of tensor in the manifold M, but of course we can also write is a sort of intrinsic object. So in order to do that, that would simply be saying, well, if I want to have K living in the tensor space of sigma, then I simply have to project my covariant derivative of N into sigma. And so this is also equivalent to the intrinsic covariant derivative of this sort of tangent vector. So basically, to take the internal, the sort of lower dimensional covariant derivative, you take the higher dimensional covariant derivative and just project everything out, that, you know, every single index gets projected down. So this is entirely equivalent to the covariant derivative simply using gamma. Yep.
Intrinsic curvature for one-dimensional manifold, which is non-vanishing, because
in what? Sorry.
In a higher dimension. I mean, if
so, you mean if I put just a line in three space dimensions? Yeah.
For example.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, because that's a difference to the normal intrinsic curvature, because a one-dimensional manifold can't be curved.
Yeah, well, actually, so I was going to give an example, not one-dimensional, but yes. So that's why, although in the sketches, okay, because we're kind of limited, I can't, you know, we've only got sort of three dimensions here, and the blackboard's only two-dimensional, right? In the sketches that I've drawn, everything looks like it's got codimension one. But I've sort of kept my little I labels, and I've been careful to sort of say that this can have codimension, whatever you like, really. Sort of depends how many dimensions you've got. So if you do lines in R cubed, yes, you can still use this formalism.
Yeah, I believe that, but I meant that's an interesting difference to an intrinsic curvature.
Yes. So we're going to see how that they are different. They're very different quantities. So I think probably a good point at which to do this example. So let's look at a cylinder in R cubed. So there are plenty of examples where when you draw a surface or some submanifold, it's actually flat in the intrinsic sense, but not in an extrinsic sense. So this is, in fact, my first example is something like that, where we've got the surface x squared plus y squared is, say, a squared, which is a subset of R cubed. And often when you first meet curvature, or if you try and explain curvature to people who've not done much mathematics, they immediately think a cylinder is curved. So, and of course, you've got to try and get, no, it's sort of persuading someone that this is flat is usually an uphill battle, and you better really not to even try and start it unless they've got a little bit of mathematical background. So in this case, our normal is, of course, radially outward pointing in the xy plane. And so HAB, so we're coming actually back to David's question here, is just delta AB minus NA NB, because we're in R cubed, it's completely flat Euclidean three-dimensional geometry. And so if we look at the components of H in a Cartesian basis, we get something that's a bit of a mess. So you can see that, first of all, coordinates make a difference. So if you can choose a set of coordinates that kind of match your submanifold, or maybe your submanifold lies naturally on a coordinate surface, then your induced metric does look reasonably straightforward. So you can see here it's a projection operator. You've got this whole line of zeros. You also see, though, it's a 3x3 matrix, yes? The top one.
What are the three columns?
So here we've got X, Y, Z.
Yeah, in the polar one.
And then, so this would be like R, theta, Z. Plane polar. Cylindrical polars, yep. So again, going through definition of the extrinsic curvature, this is codimension one, so I don't need have little I indices. So our extrinsic curvature is just going to be gamma RAB in this case. So it's just the connection bit if you're in polars. So that's as a 3x3 matrix. Just got one component sitting in the middle. So if I now look instead at the intrinsic picture, and I take coordinates theta and z, so I'm using I'm using the sort of plane polar coordinates, but just keeping the angular coordinate around the cylinder and the length up the cylinder, then I've got that my intrinsic metric is now just basically taking the bottom corner here. And the extrinsic curvature just has a single component. So really the difference between H and gamma is that gamma is now a non-degenerate symmetric two form. So that's a perfectly legitimate metric, object to think of as a metric, but of course H is degenerate. So it's, you know, it's not really, you know, strictly speaking, you couldn't invert H. But of course, inside your mind you would, because you'd simply be inverting gamma, or you take the inverse metric and again project out anything orthogonal. So that's kind of taking sort of like part of the connection, if you like. The extrinsic curvature is sort of related to a connection because it's like a first derivative of a metric. But if we have more than one normal, so this is referring back to the question about lines in R cubed, then there's actually some other quantity that I have to define, because if I've got more than one normal, then I can imagine as I move around on my manifold, the normals could actually vary. So I could have, for example, for a line sitting in our cubed, I could put some fictitious dependence of my normal as I moved along the line, simply by twisting the normals as I sort of wander along my submanifold. So there's an extra degree of freedom. Thank you. So this, not these normal fundamental forms are really telling you about the connection of the normal part of the manifold to sigma. So as I say, you could imagine allowing, say, if you just had a straight line in R cubed along the z-axis, your natural normals to take would be the x unit x and y vectors. And of course, if you then looked at derivatives of those normals, you would see that everything vanished, so everything would look completely flat. On the other hand, you could choose a coordinate system in which your, what you meant by the x-axis actually rotated as you moved along the, or up the line or up the z-axis. So in that case, you would have a non-zero connection on the normal bundle, and also if you chose those coordinates for R cubed, you'd also see that you had non-zero connection. But of course, it wouldn't mean that there was non-zero curvature. So what we can do now, is we can ask how the intrinsic curvature of sigma, so we know sigma has its own intrinsic curvature, is related to the ambient curvature of the manifold. And we can sort of sense that there's got to be two parts to this relation. So the curvature that sigma has, there's going to be some part of it that's simply inherited directly from the manifold M, but sigma could in principle also have curvature which results from its embedding. So a clear example of this is the two-sphere. We know the two-sphere, just considered as a manifold, has constant curvature. It's round. But we can also embed the two-sphere in flat R cubed. So that, in fact, that's how we always draw it. And so flat R cubed has absolutely no Riemann curvature. So therefore, the curvature of sigma is definitely not inherited from the background manifold M, but comes as a consequence of the embedding in that case. Whereas, of course, here we can see that although we have some extrinsic curvature of an embedding, we actually don't have any intrinsic curvature. So this is the Gauss equation. So the expression is that to get the intrinsic curvature of your submanifold, you first project the curvature of the ambient spacetime manifold, or ambient manifold M, and then you have to add an extra term which comes from the embedding. So that's the extrinsic piece. So we'll demonstrate this for codimension one. Simply because it's easier. So we'll do this using the Riemann identity. And so we're going to say that we're going to pick some vector which is tangent to sigma. And then we're just going to use the Riemann identity on our vector. So this is the Riemann identity expressed sort of tangent to sigma. And so now we're simply going to use the expression for this covariant derivative in terms of the higher dimensional covariant derivative. So the first derivative is going to give us an H. We have to project all of our indices down. Sorry, why did I?
What have you written that can see in front of
two.
The first equal? Oh, two.
So, sorry. I forgot the two when I wrote it in. It's a bit squeezed in there. So all I'm doing now is kind of writing out in longhand what I mean by those lower dimensional covariant derivatives. And so I've now got to laboriously take the derivative in turn of each of these objects sitting inside the bracket here. So the first one, I simply take the derivative of V. So I pull out the two H's. So that's having pulled the two H's out. Then I've got to take derivatives in turn of each of these H pieces. So that's simply, those three terms are just what I get from taking the derivative of each of the objects sitting inside that bracket. So the first term, you can see that the antisymmetry on C and D induces an antisymmetry on E and P, and the antisymmetry on E and P there, I can use the Riemann identity to get the higher dimensional Riemann tensor. So that's sort of looking good for the first term. Then if I look inside the brackets here, each of these H's is expressible in terms of so let's, for example, if I look at GQ there, HGQ is simply delta GQ minus NG NQ. So sort of plus or minus, it depends on whether N is space-like or time-like. And so if I'm taking a covariant derivative of H, I'm going to pick up extrinsic curvature terms. So if I look at the first piece here, I've got, as I've written there, NG, NQ. Now, if I take the derivative of NQ and pull out an NG, that normal will hit the first fundamental form here and just give me zero, because H projects down tangent to sigma. So the first term in brackets, let me just write. PD. So I've taken that first term that I was telling you about. So then if I look at the terms in brackets, the only thing that survives from that, from this term here, is the derivative of NG. So that's giving me actually a K, an extrinsic curvature KG. Now if I look at the second term here, then what I've got here is, again, I've got an NP and an NF, but then if I kind of look at taking derivatives of that. If I pull the NF out, it's going to meet that H and give me zero. So I have to take the derivative of NF. But then that means I've got another normal, an NP, coming through, which is going to hit here the derivative of V. So it gives me a normal derivative of V. But V is lying tangent to sigma, so its normal derivative just vanishes. So this second term doesn't give me anything at all. So I can see that the first term is now...
two covariant derivatives from the first one, and then you had minus two covariant derivatives from the other one, C goes to
two. Yeah. So I was using the Riemann identity. So the fact that you're anti-symmetrizing on C and D induces an anti-symmetry on E and P, which are the covariant derivative indices of V. So I'm using this sort of inherited anti-symmetrization here. And so now I'm just going to relabel these indices here. Because V is lying tangent to sigma, I can insert a factor of the first fundamental form there. And then for the second bit, so this I said was just K. Well, I guess I've got here with those two terms. This is going to give me a factor of the extrinsic curvature. And then I've got n dotted with grad v. And so this is going to give me simply minus vq grad p nq. So I'm using the fact that n and v are orthogonal to simply swap the role of the V and the N there. So you can now see that that just gives me another extrinsic curvature term. And so I've derived an expression there, and I realize now that I've, in fact, assumed that minus to the I was indeed a minus. So once I think I have to insert here minus minus to the I. So put that in. To allow for the fact I could have them spatial time-like. So that's derived the Gauss equation, at least in the case of codimension one. So if I wanted to express my intrinsic, my Riemann tensor fully intrinsically, then what I would have to do, I know how to do the k's intrinsically. So to do this, I would have to project my Riemann, higher dimensional Riemann indices down with this project operator, yep. So this takes you from, you know, T or T star of M into T star of sigma. That's what I use. The only sort of slight, I suppose, sleight of hand there would be the fact that to project down the upstairs, the vector index there, I mean, strictly, as I say, because you're going to lower dimensions, there's a degeneracy. So, you know, when I was saying taking the inverse of H, obviously H has no inverse when considered as a higher dimensional object. but we kind of know what we're dealing with, and so we would take the inverse of the part of H that referred to the submanifold. So it's kind of obvious how to do it, but you're basically using these projection operators. Okay. I'm done.